Welcome, everyone. If you're joining for the first time today, you're joining last week, it's totally okay. Each of these sessions, there are three of them, are standalone. And we are looking at stories in the Talmud. Just to recap, the Talmud is traditionally divided into two categories, although they can kind of blend together a little bit, and we'll talk more about that next week. But that which focuses on law, on legal discourse, and that which is really lore, which are stories. And that's the focus of our class here. Today, we're going to look at two stories, though each have slightly different versions, which we'll also take a look at, about Honi or Honi the Circle Maker. He is called the Circle Maker because he makes circles, as we'll see in today's story, which is the story where Honi gets his name from. Now, these appear in the Tractate of Ta'anit, which means fasting. And as opposed to the way we may think about fasting today in kind of contemporary Jewish society, where our main fasts are, let's say, Yom Kippur, or maybe Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, and some other minor fasts that exist throughout the year. Fasting actually was a much more common practice that the Talmud discusses, that the community would come together in times of strife, whether it's famine, drought, or some other kind of calamity. And if, let's say, drought would last for too long, then there would be elevating states of ways that the community would respond, fasting being one of them. So rain was clearly a central component in ancient Israel, something that because Israel itself only rains in the winter and doesn't get so much rain always, doesn't have something like the Nile to rely upon, if it's not raining, that can really lead to disastrous circumstances. So the response to a lack of rain, as we'll see in a moment, is kind of a core theme throughout the Tractate of Ta'anit and also elsewhere. So the first story we're going to look at comes from the Mishnah. Now, the Talmud itself, in addition to having an element of law and an element of lore, itself is divided into two major distinct texts. The first is the Mishnah, which was the code of Jewish law, which is much more concise, compiled really in the first century. And then you have the what's called the Gemara, the rest of the Talmud, which is when we think of the term Talmudic, all this legal discourse built off of the Mishnah, commenting on the Mishnah, which is a compilation of interpretation, which then really goes until about the year 500 or so. And the Mishnah was written in Israel. The Talmud, there are two of them, because we're going to see both. There's the Babylonian Talmud, after the Jews were exiled, after the destruction of the Second Temple, kind of the seat of Jewish culture was in Babylonia. But there was still a remnant that existed in the land of Israel, and they created the Jerusalem or the Palestinian Talmud. So our first text actually comes from the Mishnah. And this is a little bit surprising. There are not too many stories that appear in the Mishnah. Most of them are somewhat short, and most of them have a very clear legal kind of element to them. So this is already a somewhat surprising story and unique in this regard. But we read about this person named Honi or Honi, and we read the following. It happened that the people said to Honi, the circle drawer, "Pray for rain to fall." He prayed, and no rain fell. What did he do? He drew a circle and stood within it and exclaimed, "Master of the universe, thy children have turned to me because they believe me to be as a member of thy household, a ben bayit. I swear by thy great name that I will not move from here until you ask mercy upon my children, upon thy children." Rain then began to drip. And thereupon he exclaimed, "It is not for this that I have prayed, but for rain to fill cisterns, ditches, and caves, real rain." The rain then began to come down with a great force. And thereupon he exclaimed, "It is not for this that I have prayed, but for rain of benevolence," meaning this was too vicious of a rain, "rain of benevolence, blessing, and bounty." Rain then fell in the normal way until the Israelites in Jerusalem were compelled to go up for shelter, meaning to leave the lowlands because it was getting flooded, to the Temple Mount because of the rain. They came and said to him, to Honi, "In the same way as you have prayed for the rain to fall, pray now for the rain to cease," because they had more than their fill. He replied, "Go and see if the stone of claimants has been washed away." So this was a stone which was a high altitude. It was if you lost something, you'd kind of go up to this stone and you'd call out that you lost something and people could then see you and they would return it. Thereupon, Shimon ben Shetach, another sage, sent to him the following message. "Were it not that you were Honi, I would have placed you under the ban," meaning I would have excommunicated you. "But what can I do unto you who importune God and he accedes to your request, as a son that importunes his father and he accedes to his request? Of you, scripture says, let thy father and thy mother be glad, and let her that bore thee rejoice. So as I mentioned, this is an unusual story to appear in the Mishnah, and it's not halachic, not legal by nature. And first question you might ask is, why are people turning to this character, Honi, to ask him to pray for rain? And we can actually see a little earlier in the tractate of Ta'anit, as they're discussing how people should pray for rain when there is a shortage, when there's a drought, what do they do as it articulates the process? When they stand up to pray, they bring down before the ark an old man conversant with the prayers, one who has children and whose house is empty of food, so that his heart is complete prayer. So we see already that the person that the community is sending to be their shaliach dibor, their communal agent to pray for the community, to lead the services, is meant to be someone. You know, why they're meant to be old, maybe because they have life experience, someone who has children, a sense, kind of an immediate need that they want to look out for their children, and also someone that is really suffering in this particular moment. It's very interesting that the text here says this. They almost want someone who's poor, who's needy, to be leading you in prayer. And there's something which I think is very poignant about that. And if we try and extrapolate from that Mishnah back to our text here, I think it begins to paint potentially a somewhat sympathetic view of this man, Honi, someone who's in great need, who's older, and the people are turning to him to pray on behalf of the community. Now, it's not so clear, though, if Honi is actually such a sympathetic character. Because as we see, and we'll get into this a little bit more, in the kind of last quarter of the story, it seems as if his behavior is critiqued by this other sage named Shimon ben Shetach. And with that critique, we might wonder, oh, perhaps Honi is, say, too impetuous in the way in which he kind of makes these demands of God. And that, I think, opens up this question of what is meant to be the relationship between someone who is praying for something and the divine. Because prayer might be more one of a request, or can be seen as more, which is one of a demand. And in this case, even though the people ask Honi to pray, because his prayer is unsuccessful, he then more makes this very bold demand with very particular demands. Not just that he says it must rain, but he then critiques the amount of rain that falls. Can't be too little, can't be too much. Now, this may remind us, if we turn to source 3, of Moses, right? You may recall that Moses makes a kind of also strong demand of God in Exodus 32, where we read source 3, Moses talking to God, "Now, if you will forgive their sin, well and good, but if not, erase me from the record which you have written." So here Moses is negotiating with God in a certain way. This is certainly an incredible act of selflessness. He's basically saying, "If God, if you're not going to forgive the people, I don't care what my own personal fate is going to be. I don't want to have any part of this Torah of yours, of this story, of this book." But also, we can say that this is really, maybe Moses is overstepping in this moment, and kind of by making these demands of God. And Honi is not Moses, but I think there's perhaps a little reference there, a subtle play on what Moshe had done, what Moses has done, and what Honi is doing here. Now, also, I'd say the circle that Honi is drawing is clearly a defining act of his life. It is from this story that he gets the name, but he is known as Honi the circle drawer. And I think that could be for positive or for negative. It could be, look, this person, like Moshe, like Moses, was able to go out on a ledge here, make a demand of God, and he was successful. Potentially, though, again, this is could be seen, at least according to Shimon ben Shetach, as being, and Honi might be known for this way, in a way which is problematic, that he overstepped his bounds. But I think we want to kind of address two questions, which is, why is Shimon ben Shetach so upset? And also, what do we make of the fact that even though Shimon ben Shetach believes that Honi has acted improperly and should be punished, should be excommunicated, he can't do it, right? It seems as if he has this desire, I'm highlighting here, but the very fact that God ultimately listens to Honi indicates that there's some kind of restriction on Shimon ben Shetach's ability to censure him or to punish him. And this raises the question, is it that actually, God is really on Honi's side, and so the verdict of this story is that Shimon and Shetach is wrong? If that is the case, why is he, you know, so upset? Or potentially, no, that Honi was actually effective in his strategy, but it was still behavior that was improper. Now, there is another version of this story, which we find quoted in the Gemara, in that other half of the Talmud, but also from a Tannaitic source, from the time of the Tannaim, which is the time of the Mishnah. And this version is slightly different, but there we read the following, here in source 4. Shimon ben Shetach said to him, "If you were not Honi, I would decree a ban against you. For if the years were like the years of Elijah, when the keys to reign were in Elijah's hands, would it not result in the desecration of the name of heaven because of you?" So we're going to look into what that means in a moment. Story there continues. "But what can I do for you, since you appeal before the omnipresent and he fulfills your will, like a son who appeals to his father and he fulfills his will? It is as if you say to him, 'Father, take me to bathe in hot water, rinse me in cold water, give me nuts, almonds, peaches, and pomegranates.' And he gives them to you. About you, the verse states, 'May your father and your mother rejoice, and may she who bore you be glad.'" So a very similar story, but with slight differences. And in particular, this whole case of this question of Elijah and what exactly is going on here. So this notion of keys that Elijah was in possession of, which of course is understood in some kind of allegorical way, actually comes, if you can see here on page 3, from the another tractate in the Talmud, that of the tractate of Sanhedrin, source number 6. And here we read the following. I'm skipping 5, which is Rashi's commentary on the previous text. Read the following. "Elijah prayed that God give him the key of the resurrection of the dead. But he was told from heaven, 3 keys were never entrusted to a messenger, but remained with God. Namely, the key of childbirth, the key of rain, and the key of the resurrection of the dead. You already have the key of rain, and you also want the key of the resurrection of the dead? It will be said that 2 keys are held by the disciple and 1 by the master. Give back the key of rain and take the key of the resurrection of the dead." This is a very powerful text. It's also somewhat enigmatic. First, the general thrust of this is that there are 3 specific powers that God remains in complete control over and doesn't entrust in some other form of leader or prophet or whatever it is to have any role in their existence in the world. All 3 of them have to do with life. Childbirth, that's the most obvious. Resurrection of the dead, also, someone who's dead to bring them back to life. And then rain, water is, of course, the key to all sustenance, both to drink and for planting, etc., to create food. So all of these have to do with life. Now, it's very strange because in this text, we see that God is saying, or the text is saying, that God maintains control, kind of direct control over these 3 things. And yet, immediately following this, we see that actually Elijah has control over rain. Now, a very similar text also appears in our tractate in Ta'anit. And there, it doesn't say anything about God giving over one of the keys to Elijah. It just says that God maintains these specific 3 keys. So you already see some kind of tension here. Is it that God alone maintains control over these 3 things, or that Elijah, in fact, actually has some kind of access to this particular key? And if so, why only 1, and why can't he have access to 2? According to the way this text is written out, Elijah can have only 1 at a time, lest he have the majority, and somehow that would be problematic, but it's not a problem for him to have only 1. And so if he wants to gain the ability to resurrect the dead, he then has to exchange the key of rain with God. So this is what's being referenced here in this other story. And it's not entirely clear exactly what Shimon ben Shetach's critique is here, but somehow it seems as if Honi may be elevating himself to the level of Elijah. And there might be a problem which exists there. But again, even the story of Elijah, it's not clear what is the human role and what is God's role. And Alex Israel, who's a rabbi in Jerusalem, he teaches at the Pardes Institute, he discusses this. this particular story of Elijah, and he says the following. He says, there's a tension here, source number 7. Does the key to rainfall lie in God's hands or in Eliyahu's? That's the Hebrew name for Elijah. This midrash raises a question which lurks in the background throughout the Elijah stories. As Elijah seems to make pronouncements and enact miracles independently, we are always left wondering whether Elijah is acting by God's agency or whether he is instigating acts with which God somehow follows along. Right? Is he just sort of the messenger of God, or can he actually make demands and then miracles occur? God listens to him. The Midrash proposes that indeed God lends his keys to Elijah. Elijah has unusual power to a degree that is customarily in God's jurisdiction. And yet, God makes it clear that Elijah's power has its limits. God is firmly in the driving seat. So by comparing Honi to Elijah, and I think we can already begin to see a potential critique that exists here of Shimon ben Shetach of Honi, either he's offering, I think, a critique which could be even levied against Elijah, which is, what's going on here? Are you really kind of taking this key? Are you usurping what's meant to be a divine power and making that a human one? Or at the very least, it's that Honi is elevating himself to a role that only Elijah himself had. But the core, I think, tension that seems to exist here is whether or not Honi is acting properly. And Shimon ben Shetach seems to be suggesting that the answer is no, that you are overextending yourself and or you are kind of usurping something which is from the divine realm, something almost magical in the way that you are drawing this circle and that you are making this demand of God. I think one question which I haven't actually seen discussed is, what is the significance of him actually drawing this circle? Obviously, it's a rhetorical device. He's saying, I won't leave from this spot until God, you listen. But maybe there's something which is also meant to kind of evoke a sense of something which is magical, of divination. And that for sure would be even further on the side of something which is problematic. And so Shimon ben Shetach is critiquing Honi for overstepping his bounds and potentially even for engaging in something which is close to sorcery. And his inability to ultimately ban Shimon ben Shetach might be a political thing, that God basically listens to you and now you've brought rain for the people, so what can I do? Or it might be that Honi actually is somehow successful and that indicates that God is either on his side, or if not, that he actually has some kind of almost magical powers, in which case Shimon ben Shetach doesn't want to challenge him. But this is emphasized, I think, by Ephraim Orbach, who was a major 20th century scholar, died in the 1990s. He was at Hebrew U. And he really reads our story as Shimon ben Shetach opposing the miracle worker. He says the following. He says, the common people were, of course, interested in one thing only, in the result of the action, right? They don't have water. They need water. Doesn't matter to them how exactly this water will come about without differentiating its source. On the other hand, the interest of the sages was focused on emphasizing the fact that it was God who wrought the miracle rather than on the miraculous act. Hence, we find that their attitude towards miracles, without which, as we have stated, religion cannot be envisaged, is ambivalent. The point is brought into relief in the well-known story about Honi HaMa'agal, Honi the circle drawer, and the attitude of Shimon ben Shetach to his actions. Honi worked a great miracle. He uttered a decree, and the Holy One, blessed be he, fulfilled it, and brought down rain when it was most needed. But Shimon ben Shetach sent word to him, were you not Honi HaMa'agal, Honi the circle maker, I would pronounce a ban against you. One cannot fail to sense in Shimon ben Shetach's words an expression of concern, lest the language used by Honi, I swear by thy great name that I will not stir from here, and the act that he performed, that he drew the circle and stood inside it, should be misconstrued. Only Honi's personality and the veneration in which he was held by the people saved him from being banned. So it seems that Shimon ben Shetach is concerned with Honi's actions, potentially on their own, that he himself has taken them, or perhaps for the broader ramifications, that people will begin to believe that we have miracle workers, and that ultimately all these miracles come from God. And even if somehow Honi is able to elicit that, because remember, he was asked to pray, and one could view what he's doing as being just an extreme form of prayer. So really, the miracle is still in God's hands. But because it was such a dramatic act, complete with this circle, which feels, again, almost ritualistic, Perhaps Honi would be misconstrued by the people and they would begin to believe in magic. So Shimon Shetach might be a little less concerned with Honi's own actions and more with the lessons that other people are going to derive from them. Now, one other contemporary scholar on this text, Isaiah ben Pazi, also in Israel at Bar Ilan, and he actually really zooms in on the language of this text, specifically the way that Honi refers to himself and the way that Shimon ben Shetach refers to Honi. He writes the following. He says, I wish to suggest that the concept ben bayit, which is kind of a member of the household, that appears in the story of Honi the circle maker, is a manager who enjoyed the trust of the owner and had the authority to administer his property. Right? This is how Honi self-describes his relationship with God. He says, I am a ben bayit. Shimon ben Shetach, abbreviated here as SBS, does not repeat the term ben bayit when referring to Honi. He objects to the self-definition of Honi, who compared himself to a ben bayit, and instead compares him to a son who implores his father. Right? So you have here, as Honi states, why was Honi able to be effective according to his own understanding, God? Because he's a ben bayit. He's a member of the house. He has some kind of authority of what happens in the divine realm. And Shimon ben Shetach's response is much more subtle. He's basically saying, no, the reason why you were effective is not because you yourself have any authority or control, but because you're like a son who's employing their father. God still gets to make the decisions here, but God has mercy upon you, and therefore God accedes to your request. Ben Pazi continues. He says, the conflict between Honi and Shimon ben Shetach was because Honi saw himself as a ben bayit of God, which is someone who is, on the one hand, a slave of a master, but also, on the other hand, has confidence from his master who gives him authority to make decisions by himself concerning the household. This description seems to be upheld by the way he was able to ask for hard rain or soft rain at will. Shimon ben Shetach was afraid that the presentation would lead to divination of Honi by the masses, and this, in turn, would be an infraction on the pure monotheism of the Jewish religion. He therefore refers to Honi as a pampered son who asks his father for all that he wants, and his father grants it to him, even if they are contradictory requests, such as hot water and cold water. This definition can explain Honi's accomplishments without leaving room for divination. So we see here, according to this reading, Shimon ben Shetach is critiquing Honi as being, right, this person who, right, is a little bit of a spoiled kind of child, pampered. But at the same time, what he's really doing is he's allowing the events to unfold as they unfolded, but offering a different lens on which to view them, which is Honi views himself as having authority and power. And Shimon ben Shetach basically says, yes, you went, you made the circle, you made this pronouncement, it was effective, but not for the reasons you believe, because this is basically how prayer works, a child beseeching their parent and their parent responding. And I think this is a beautiful reading of this text. It's a close reading of the particular words. But also, it then means that Shimon ben Shetach is less of an overarching critique and more of this very subtle reframing, which I think is rather brilliant in the way that now the events can still unfold as they unfolded, but with a remarkably different understanding and interpretation. That is story number one. We are now going to go to story number two, and then we'll wrap them all up together. Story number two appears in the piece of the Talmud in Ta'anit that is commenting on the mission that we saw. And we have another story of Honi. Rabbi Yochanan said, this righteous man, who is Honi, was throughout his life distressed by the meaning of the verse, a song of ascents, when the Lord returned the exiles to Zion. It was like a dream. Beginning of Shir HaMalot that we say often, many of us, on Shabbat and holidays when we are saying grace after meals, from Psalms 126. He would say, who could sleep and dream for 70 years? Meaning Honi is struggling to understand what is happening here. What does it mean that someone, it was like a dream when the Israelites or the Jews returned to Zion after the first exile? So to teach him a lesson, we have the following story. One day he was walking on the road and saw a man planting a carob tree. Honi asked him, How long does it take for this tree to bear fruit? The man replied, 70 years. Pony said to him, are you certain that you will live another 70 years? The man replied, I found a world full of carob trees, meaning when I was born. As my forefathers planted for me, I too plant for my descendants. Pony sat down to have a meal, and sleep overcame him. As he slept, a cliff formed around him, which hid him from sight, and he continued to sleep for 70 years. When he awoke, he saw a man gathering the fruit of the carob tree. He asked him, are you the man who planted the tree? The man replied, I am his grandson. Thereupon, Pony exclaimed, it is clear that I have slept for 70 years. He then caught sight of his ass who had given birth to several generations of mules, and he returned home. He there inquired, is the son of Pony the circle drawer still alive? The people replied, his son is not, but his grandson. He said to them, I am Pony the circle drawer. But no one would believe him. He then went to the study hall, where he overheard the scholar say, this law is as luminous to us as in the days of Pony the circle drawer. Whenever he would enter the study hall, he would settle for the scholars any difficulties that they had. Whereupon he called out, I am he, meaning I am Pony. But the scholars would not believe him, nor did they give him the honor due to him. This hurt him greatly, and he prayed for death, and he died. Rava said, this is what people say, either friendship or death. So this is a very dramatic story with a number of different plot twists. And it can really be thought of as having three different components to it. The core part of this is a very common motif, a very common folklore that we find in lots of different contexts in both Greek and Christian, English, American. Think of King Arthur, Rip Van Winkle. And that kind of story, these long slumber stories, have four components to them typically. We have a cultural hero who sleeps in some kind of protected space, sleeps for many years, and then awakens to a changed ideal future. Now, our story here is different. First of all, Pony does not wake up to find a world which is redeemed. In fact, it's one which is frightening to him, and he is pained by it, leading him ultimately to pray for his own death. We also have the way in which this story is framed. The beginning is a much more kind of rabbinic introduction, rabbinic style, where we have a particular verse, which is hard to understand, and the rabbis often perform some form of exegesis on a verse to understand it. So the main folklore story really appears only after that. So there's a rabbinic introduction or framing. And then we also have some other elements, especially towards the end, that are hallmarks of the kind of final editorial hand of the Talmud, known as the Stama'im. So if we think of what the Talmud is comprised of, as I mentioned before, we have the Mishnah, which was the sages through the first century. And then we have the next subsequent few centuries are the rabbis. And that first group of people are called the Tana'im and the teachers. They all kind of mean teachers. Amora'im also means teachers. And this was the group that is commenting on the Mishnah itself, the rabbis of the Gemara. And for a long time, that was kind of basically understood to be that the Talmud was redacted with the conclusion of the Amora'im. Critical work done by David Weiss Halivni and Shema Friedman, they pioneered this work, and then others, came to understand that the subsequent anonymous editor of the Talmud actually played a much stronger hand than we realized in stitching the text together, in formulating questions in certain ways. And they are called the Stama'im, which means basically the anonymous ones. And some of the kind of core elements of how the Stama'im stitched together the Talmud had to do a lot with the study hall itself. And so we see the Stama'itic imprint on this text, where this final piece of it has to do with Pony coming to the study hall here. Some things to point out upon close reading. So one, Pony seems uninterested in the future, where he almost scoffs at this man who's planting a tree for future generations. He offers no response to this man who's planting the tree when the man says that he's planting it for future generation. I mean, one could kind of initially look at this as Honi just being naive. What are you doing? Why are you planting this? But he doesn't say, oh, wow, that's such a virtuous act. He kind of just walks away from when this person explains that he's planting for a future generation. He doesn't seem to appreciate any kind of act of altruism for the future. A second point of intrigue is when he walks into his home and he has the opportunity to, sorry, before that, when Honi encounters the planter's grandson, right? He now wakes up at 70 years later. He may have had this revelation of, wow, I was around 70 years ago when your grandfather was planting this tree, and now I can really see how you've benefited from that moment. But again, Honi kind of just walks away. His only lesson that he learns from this is, I must have slept for 70 years. Doesn't seem to be getting what I think should be the lesson of the story, which is to understand why this person was planting the tree and the significance and importance of doing acts of altruism for the future. In the second scene, when Honi goes home, he doesn't care to meet his grandson. He asks if his children are still alive. He's told no. He's told, but your grandson is. And he doesn't ask. And this is a very painful, I think, story. He doesn't ask, well, let me see my grandson. And perhaps here, there's also sort of touching on the same theme that, you know, a relationship, especially when people's life expectancy were shorter, you know, a person caring for their child, there's maybe immediate act of altruism that takes place there. But you also get that immediate reward. Investing in the next generation, one's grandchildren, you may not actually live to see your grandchildren. That might not have been so common. And so that requires some kind of active imagination to think about the future in perpetuity, where there's no immediate gratitude that you receive for any acts that you do. And so the fact that Honi dismisses this and has no interest in meeting his grandson, I think suggests to us that he really has no interest in this notion of a future where there's no immediate recognition for his own work. The third scene, when he goes into the study hall, again, which I mentioned, this is a hallmark of the Stamaitic imprint, talking about the house of study. Unlike the story of Moses that we saw in last week's Agadah, for those of you who were here last week, Moses in that case was lost in terms of the discourse that was taking place. But when he was told that the things that are being studied came from Moses, he was relieved. In this case, Honi does not seem to care that people know that it came from him. He wants the immediate recognition. He wants the members of the House of Study to recognize that he is Honi, so we can get the gratitude of the respect that he believes he deserves. And yet, that is not forthcoming, and that leads for him to go and pray for his own death. What's interesting in the end of the story, which certainly is tragic, is we see reinforced here that Honi seems to have these almost magical powers. He prays for his death, and he in fact receives that divine action. He doesn't take his own life. God then listens to his request here at the end. The final line here, Rava said, this is what people say, either friendship or death. It seems to be saying that because Honi is not recognized in the house of study, one can either have that kind of friendship. And by the way, the term here is chavruta, which means friend, but for those of you who are also familiar with the other usage, it really means colleagueship. So when two people study together, they are called colleagues. They're called chavrutas. And so here, this final statement, which most scholars believe was stitched on, was not part of the original story, is also maybe trying to say something about the academy, again, the Stamaitic voice, that there's nothing better than the camaraderie that you have with your colleagues. And because Honi's not himself actually recognized, his life then feels almost like it is meaningless. Now, this story has a parallel in the Jerusalem Talmud. So as I mentioned before, we're seeing really two stories, but each of which has other parallels. And there, it's similar in some ways, but also I'd say dramatically different. So the story as it appears in the Jerusalem Talmud, which most scholars believe would have been the original text, is as follows. Honi the circle drawer was the grandson of Honi the circle drawer, passed down from generation to generation, who lived close to the destruction of the temple, which is not mentioned really at all in our first story. Honi went out to his workers in the field. While he was there, it rained. He entered a cave. Once he sat down, he became drowsy and fell asleep. He remained sound asleep for 70 years until the temple was destroyed and rebuilt a second time. It was a 70-year interstitial time between the destruction of the first temple, the initial exile, and then the redemption that came after. At the end of the 70 years, he awoke from his sleep. He went out of the cave and saw a changed world. A place that had been planted with vineyards now produced olives, and a place that had been planted with olives now produced grain. He asked the people of the city, "What is going on in the world?" They said to him, "Don't you know what is going on in the world?" He said to them, "No." They said to him, "Who are you?" He said to them, "Pony the circle drawer." They said to them, "We heard that when he would go into the temple courtyard, it would be illuminated," meaning that pony, meaning we've heard of this man from 70 years ago, who, when he would enter the temple, it would, there kind of a light would shine forth from him. He, meaning Honi, went in and illuminated the place. He applied to himself the verse, "When the Lord returned the exiles to Zion, it was like a dream." So here, there are a number of differences between this text and the one in the Babylonian Talmud. First of all, the exegesis comes only at the very end. We see that there's a focus here on the temple itself, as opposed to the study hall. And that very much was, again, the Stama'im of the Babylonian Talmud very much wanted to kind of shift the focus away from the temple to the house of study. It became kind of the new temple once the temple was destroyed. I mean, the temple is destroyed here in the Jerusalem Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud also, but the Stama'im of the Babylonian Talmud very much, that's a hallmark of some of the transformations that they make in various texts. The story here has a, I'd say, a positive end. By many ways, you know, what I mentioned before, that there are kind of the four hallmarks of this kind of slumber story that exists throughout cultures or cross cultures. One of them is that the person wakes up and the world is transformed in a positive way to kind of an idyllic world. And we see that that's very much true for Honi. He wakes up, the temple is, second temple is there. There's no shame that he experiences at the end and wanting to die. Though the people don't explicitly say that they recognize him, when they ask him, "Who are you?" and he says, "Honi the circle drawer," it seems as if they accept that. So he has a sense of self and recognition. I'm not entirely sure what to make of that place that planted with vineyards now produced olives and so forth. My guess is that it's actually an upgrade in some way. So even the produce has now been upgraded. And then the last thing, which I think is also important, and we'll delve into this a bit in a moment, is Honi here is really being seen as a miracle worker again, right? This kind of physical light that's just illuminating from him. Whereas in the text in the Babylonian Talmud, even when they are praising Honi, again, they don't recognize him, so they're talking about the figure who was Honi, it was that he was a great sage. He was someone who was able to answer all difficulties. Again, that's also part of a hallmark of the transformation that the Babylonian Talmud would have, which is moving away from miracle workers to prioritizing or kind of highlighting more, praising the sage. And this, I think, is one way in which, or the main way, in which our story here actually, or the two different stories may actually kind of coalesce. Because, oh, actually, before we do that, though, I just wanted to share with you Jeffrey Rubinstein, who I mentioned last week, one of the best scholars on rabbinic stories. He kind of lays out in a chart the differences between, that I've already articulated, but the differences between the story in the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. But kind of now, if we want to think about what are our takeaways from each of these stories individually and together, the first story, the thrust of it is really to downplay miracles, that Shimon ben Shetach comes along and critiques Honi the circle maker, who is kind of playing the role of a miracle worker. In the second story, we also see that scholarship is emphasized over the miracle worker. In the first case, it's not so much scholarship, it might be kind of prayer, but there's a parallel there, there's a similarity there that Honi is being the transformation from the Jerusalem Talmud to the Babylonian Talmud, which really paints Honi in a much worse light. It's trying, I think, to suppress this notion of the value of a miracle worker, whereas in the Jerusalem Talmud, Honi is just kind of praised for who he is and that he light shines forth from him. So we have, I think, a general theme between these two different texts in the Babylonian Talmud. Each one is trying to suppress this the value of a miracle worker, either in order to elevate prayer or to elevate scholarship. We also have, I think, this moral lesson of doing for others without personal recognition in the second case, to plant seeds that will bear fruit only in the future and for others without any sort of personal recognition for one's acts. And perhaps this is a warning also we see here to scholars about one's own ego, So even in this transformation, moving away from the miracle worker, away from the temple to scholarship, there are pitfalls that can occur there. And one of them, I think, is, you know, if you've ever kind of been in a debate or in a class and you kind of raise your hand and you make a point and that point is decisive and you kind of defeat the other argument, there's an immediate recognition of your self-worth and the way in which your ego gets fed immediately, as opposed to, right, if you're planting carob trees, they'll only bear fruit in two generations that you won't be around to see. You don't get to actually experience the recognition for your effort there. And so perhaps here, that's part of the thrust of this story, is that Honi is meant to learn, and a warning to people that you need to be thinking about other people in an altruistic way and not about feeding your own ego. And kind of the last piece to this, which I think is stated very nicely by Gila Fine, who's a scholar in Jerusalem, recently wrote a book about women in the Talmud and Talmudic stories. She really believes that the thrust of the story is to teach us that redemption comes about through a step-by-step altruistic process. She writes, "Redemption for the rabbis takes time. The world cannot be made perfect overnight, any more than a tree can bear fruit instantaneously, or the exile pass as swiftly as a dream. Hence, Honi, contrary to other super sleepers," meaning in other traditions, "is made to wake up into a world still in need of toil and care. The rabbis of the Bavli understand that there are no shortcuts. No magic sleeps on the way to utopia. It is only through consistent human endeavor, another tree, another child, another teaching, another good deed, that the world will become perfect in the end." I think this summarizes really these two stories taken together. We're not looking for, we are not meant to be miracle workers. And similarly, we are not meant to see a transformation that will take place instantaneously. That the way that the world ultimately gets improved is through these kind of these acts of kindness, of altruism, that take a long time to ultimately bear fruition. But it is through those acts that ultimately the world will be transformed and the world will be redeemed.